I'm Richard Bennett, and this is the High Tech Forum podcast, your go-to place for thoughtful, well-informed networking and tech policy discussion. Today, I'm speaking with Shane Tews, a colleague of mine at the American Enterprise Institute's Center for Internet Communications and Technology Policy, where she works primarily on cybersecurity and internet governance issues. Shane is also the Chief Policy Officer at 463 Communications, a firm that advises high-tech organizations on internet policy. Shane's dealt with internet security and domain issues as Vice President of Global Policy for VeriSign, and she's currently the Vice Chair of the Board of Directors of the Internet Education Foundation, a nonprofit whose mission is to promote a decentralized global internet. She began her career on Capitol Hill as a legislative director for a member of Congress and then worked in the George H.W. Bush White House, in the Office of Cabinet Affairs, and at the U.S. Department of Transportation. So, hello, Shane.
So, where were you earlier this week? You were at a conference?
Yes, I went to the Attis Forum on 5G in Chicago, where the actual players in developing 5G systems and standards met to share their visions. The most expansive view was from Cisco because they see a need for a better internet. They see more potential than simply bolting on a faster radio to the existing mobile broadband system. There are some exciting opportunities just around the corner for applications that unlock the power that 5G and a better internet bring to our ability to browse for information, communicate, and extend IT into the home, the office, and the car. Some cool stuff is coming.
So is 5G just, is that a measurement of how much, like, what is 5G? Let's start with that.
Oh, okay. Well, in cellular telephony, you know, has a standards organization called 3GPP that devises the rules that all the different mobile operators use to ensure interoperability. And the standard that we're on right now is 4G. It's the fourth generation.
Okay.
Of cellular standards, and 5G will be the next generation. So you remember how we used to have 3G mobile broadband on, yeah, our phone?
Are there still places in the world where 3G is the standard because they just don't have the technical capability to be at 4G yet?
Well, in the U.S., we pretty much have 4G everywhere now.
Okay.
And we were the first country in the world, actually, to deploy 4G at this kind of massive scale that we have. But it's also, and 4G is also known as LTE. And okay. So if you have, you know, an iPhone or an Android phone that you bought within the last 3 years, it's a 4G LTE compatible phone. And your mobile operator, whoever it is, if it's one of the big five, provides LTE service, you know, in most places where most people live.
So I thought LTE was specific to one carrier. Is that, but it's just a terminal?
No, it's LTE is an international standard.
Okay.
And so you have if you have an iPhone with LTE, you can actually use it in Europe and Asia.
Yeah, you can. It just costs more.
Well, yeah. Right. But that's actually, it's changing a bit. It's coming down from what it used to be. And what you do is you get a SIM card for the operator whose network you're going to be using in Europe or Asia, and doesn't really cost that much more than using it in the U.S.
So what's the excitement about 5G? What, faster, smarter leaps?
Well, it'll be faster and smarter, and mostly that the at the high, at sort of at the 50,000 foot level, the thing that changes between one generation and the next is more speed. That's what everybody wants, and they also want lower latency.
Okay.
And lower latency is what permits phone calls to work over the broadband component of your network. And so historically, you know, the cellular network was designed for telephone calls. And so in 1G and 2G, it was pretty much only telephone calls. Although in 2G, you could do limited amounts of data. You can also do text messaging. In 3G, 3G was really a data standard that supplemented the telephone call capability of the cellular network by letting you do some web surfing. And although it was tended to be at fairly low speeds, it'd be like maybe 250 kilobits per second up to maybe a couple of megs. But they kept the data and the voice elements separate. And 4G is we're at the cusp now of a voice capability emerging on LTE over it's a data only network. And so it's essentially voice over IP.
And so speeding it up makes it more similar to what we're used to from a voice quality.
Yeah, the low latency makes it similar to what we're used to in terms of the quality of the telephone calls. So you know how when you use Skype, sometimes it works really great and it's really just awesome, and sometimes it doesn't really work at all.
Yeah.
Well, what the LTE people want to do is make voice over LTE work really awesome all the time, so that you have high definition voice and it actually sounds better than the traditional plain old telephone service network.
I think if it sounded better, I would get to choose a funny accent and it would just automatically change everything that I say.
Well, you could probably, there's an app for that. And so the thing is, these wireless generations, they typically run for about 5 to 10 years. And before even the 4G standards were completed, there were people in this 3GPP association, which is all the wireless carriers and the equipment vendors like Cisco and Qualcomm and those folks, started working on the next generation on 5G before 4G was even finished. And there have been a lot of different opinions about what we need in the next generation of cellular technology. And, you know, it sort of ranges from better voice quality over the data connection to just higher speeds to better integration between what's called macro cells and small cells, which is to say stuff that gives you all the benefits of mobility, but also higher data rates when you're in densely populated urban areas, which can sometimes be kind of dicey with cellular.
Is that because of a high user rate, or what causes that?
Well, there's a couple of different issues. One of them is when you're in the urban jungle, the radio wave propagation is kind of chaotic because you got so many surfaces that the radio waves bounce off of, buildings and windows, trees, cars. So it's hard to plan the network so that the radio coverage is uniform throughout an entire, say, inner city area. And you also have a more dense population. So cellular cell towers are pretty much designed to support about 1,000 users per tower. And if you have more than 1,000 people, or if the people are doing really data intensive things like streaming video, you have to reduce that number to maybe 100 or 200 in order for people to all get, you know, the kind of quality that they expect when they're streaming video to their mobile devices. So those are the problems that have to be tackled, and there are several different proposed solutions, and it has kind of always been the case that 5G was all things to all people, because there were, you know, half a dozen different groups that had their own concept of what 5G should be. But there seems to be, within the last 6 months or so, I'd say there's been a major convergence of thinking about where 5G should go. And there's a recognition that really the only way we're going to get to the high speeds that folks want to have is to get more spectrum.
Oh, okay.
And it's also the case that, you know, it needs to support small cells better. It needs to integrate with Wi-Fi better. The advent of LTE unlicensed is really beneficial to 5G because it's a way to combine licensed and unlicensed spectrum using a common protocol that sort of makes all the roaming and everything that you want to do across different network boundaries work better. And the most fascinating view on it that I heard was a fellow from Cisco who I'm hoping to do a podcast with fairly soon. who presented. Cisco has a really coherent corporate position about what 5G should do that combines the development of better and more advanced radio technology with a transformation of the internet protocols themselves. And this is something that I've been harping on for a long time because, and Dave Farmer and I talked about it in the podcast that I did with him. The internet was designed 40 years ago. And all the technologies that we use today are between 1,000 to 1,000,000 times more powerful than they were then. And the time has really come to rethink how the internet works, how the different parts fit together. So that we can resolve some of these problems like privacy and security, get rid of the denial of service attacks, reduce the spam, and just generally make it a more friendly and robust system than, you know, could have been built 40 years ago.
And is it a redesign of the way the network operates that you think would enable denial of service attacks to be either minimized or dissipated, and same thing with privacy and security?
Yeah. So it's rethinking the whole, the way the way computers are addressed on the internet, and also the how the names work. And the way Cisco talks about it, it's a transitioning of the internet from a sort of a number-based system to a name-based system.
So can you give me an example on that?
Yeah, so when you want to stream a movie, instead of what you do today is you select a location first. Like you decide you want to stream that movie from Netflix. Same movie may be available to you on Amazon, Amazon Prime, Instant Video, whatever they call that. May be available from your video on demand option on your cable provider. So you could potentially say if you want to watch what Fast and Furious 6, everybody's favorite movie. you can get it several different places, but in a name, and you have to tell your computer where to go to get that content. And then you go to that place and you look at their catalog and you fetch, you know, what you want out of their catalog. In a name-based networking scenario, what would happen is you would essentially tell your browser that you want to watch Fast and Furious 6. And it would give you a menu of choices that were some are going to be closer to you and better quality, maybe renderings than others. And you can pick the particular, it's essentially pick the file that you want that has that movie in it that is that's best for you, based on what kind of device you're on and where you are. So it's a question of, you know, bringing the person in contact with the content that they want, irrespective of how the internals of the network are put together. So it gives us a lot more flexibility in terms of how we engineer the specifics of the way that the network moves information from one point to another. And also gives us a better range of choices and more quality.
And then along with that, you could put in the either authentication mechanisms or, you know, the parameters that would allow for kind of some of the policy things you mentioned.
Right.
Privacy and, you know, interesting.
And so, you know, the internet's really vulnerable to denial of service attacks today, right?
Yeah.
And the reason for that is the way the internet operates at a high level is that you start getting data from somebody and then you figure out if that's somebody that you want to get data from.
Right.
And this is why denial of service attacks are possible because, you know, you're running your browser. You can be getting data from somebody that, you know, you don't even know. You don't know where it's coming from. They just decided to send you a denial of service attack. But in the name-based scenario, you're only going to get the data that you ask for, you know, which makes it really difficult. The only way you could do a denial of service attack is to impersonate a data source that people go to and request data from. And if we can authenticate properly, then that's going to be extremely hard to do.
So to stick with your movie example, I'm at home. I want to watch Fast and Furious. I typed it into my browser and it says, here are three options of which would I have to have a subscription to one of those or
it was? Oh yeah, you'd have to. I mean, we're not talking about changing the business relationships. I mean, you'd probably you would only be able to actually get it from sources that you were authorized to use.
Okay. But you'd be part of that. It'd be you pre-selected because you have a subscription with them and then you already have a relationship with them. So there wouldn't be somebody knocking on my browser that I don't know. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's really,
yeah. And you know, you'd probably have an option where you could say, just show me sources that I'm authorized to use or show me all sources. And then if it's only available, say from Vudu and you don't have a Vudu account, then you could go open a Vudu account. Wanted that particular piece of content.
So what would it take for us to get to that utopia?
Well, one of the things we have to do is redesign DNS, the domain name service. Because what it does right now is something that's called early binding. So when you look up Amazon or Google on DNS, you get an IP address where you can reach that service, and then you use that to use that IP address, and sort of everybody forgets about the name. But it doesn't really have to work that way, right? Because what you're using to browse is a URI, or some people still call it a URL, which is actually the name of the service, right? And you could, instead of using the IP address in the information packets that you send to contact Amazon, you could send the name through the network and essentially get a path for the entire URI that Amazon could resolve into IP addresses at only after it gets to their site. And so that's called late binding. And that gives Amazon a whole lot more flexibility about how to handle the traffic that they're sending out. So they could load balance their network. So if the Amazon server that's the closest to you is overloaded, they might want to send you to one that's a one hop farther away. And it would be real easy to do that more or less in real time. If the decision about resolving the name into a numerical address was made later in the process than it is today.
So how do we get there? I mean, I'm understanding the positive effects of a change in the system, and I mm-hmm. understand how the current system works. I'm trying to figure out how we get from the current system to what you're talking about.
Well, that's the 64 gigabyte question, isn't it? Because there have been, for 20 years, people have been coming up with all these great ideas about how to make a better internet. And then when you get down to the practicalities of how do we move people from where we are to this utopia, things get really, really complicated. I'm sure you're aware of IPv6, right?
Right.
And so the internet that most people use today uses a protocol called IPv4. It's version 4 of internet protocol, and versions 1 through 3 kind of never went anywhere.
Why is there not a 5? Did we just go past 5?
5 was essentially aborted. So there was a IP version 5 was an attempt to do some things that it turns out really couldn't be done. And so it's actually is a definition for it, but nobody's ever really used it at scale.
Okay. So if we get to 6, which a lot of people have been driving to 6 for a long time, say we actually get there and most of the world is using it. I mean, I guess I think about how, I didn't think 5 years ago I would be able to just tap on an app and get all the neat stuff I can now.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way for the market to evolve without having to do a lot of protocol changes, or are there a lot of changes that would need to take place to get to late binding versus early binding?
You know, I think that that's the beauty of it, is that you could essentially get to late binding by changing the web protocols. You wouldn't really have to necessarily go in and replace every router, or we could even continue to use IPv4. It just would be used in a different way. So the one of the examples that this guy made was that when you're listening to a song on Spotify, mm-hmm. and you're in your office, and so the IP address that you're using to contact Spotify is the IP address of your desktop Ethernet connection, is essentially what it is, or Wi-Fi connection. And then you leave your office and you go out on the street. You have a different IP address because now you're going through the cellular network. But Spotify knows who you are, and they know that you've changed IP addresses, and they're able to continue streaming that same song to you, even though you have hopped from one network to another, and even from one IP address to another. And so there's like a big insight in there, is that a lot of these problems with security and mobility are being solved by the applications themselves, which is an interesting scenario because the applications tend to solve them in slightly different ways. But if there was a common way of, say, logging on to a service and authenticating yourself and maintaining connections across different networks, and maybe even combining so you could use like two or three networks at the same time. If you were doing something that was really madly data intensive, you could use your Ethernet, your Wi-Fi, and maybe your cellular connection all at the same time. That's an achievable thing for an application to do, but there just isn't a common mechanism in the internet for making that happen across all applications in a uniform way. So it's essentially just a question of adding some stuff to the internet that hasn't been a part of it historically in terms of a common standard that everybody uses. And we get away from, say, Spotify, Pandora, and Amazon and Netflix all have to reinvent the wheel when they do their login and authentication and account management. So you devise some standards for doing that, and then we can start thinking about, well, we simplify applications for one thing, because they don't have to do this stuff, which is really common, and we can do stuff in a whole lot richer way with better protection.
So which standards bodies would we have to go to start the IETF process?
Well, I mean, 3GPP and IETF would have to work together to make all this stuff work. And once it's done for mobile, then we'd actually want to have the same thing on wired networks too.
Interesting. Do you think that's something that a market force can get us there? If there starts to be enough interest, these working groups come up with a way for it to be coordinated, or is that enough of a driver?
Well, I think this is one of these, are you an optimist or a pessimist questions? And the pessimistic view is the internet is so big and there's so many people on it, you can't really change anything. But which is, I think, true. It's like you look at, we were talking about IPv6 a minute ago. IPv6 was actually designed 15 years ago. And it's supposed to be the next generation of internet protocols. But the difference between internet generations and cellular generations, the cellular generations are real and people actually build product around them and they use them and implement them. Internet generations are pretty much just paper tigers. So we have this standards body called the Internet Engineering Task Force that does a lot of good work, but an awful lot of the work that they do really doesn't ever go anywhere. So they publish a new standard, but then if nobody uses it, well, it just sort of joins the ash heap of history, and that was a fun exercise, but it didn't really accomplish anything.
Is that because moving the internet is just a bigger vessel? It's like moving a aircraft carrier versus the nimble element of mobile.
Yeah, I mean it's bigger, and it's also the Internet Engineering Task Force isn't really in a position to force people to use any of the standards that they devise. So it's just a real loosey-goosey kind of scenario where it's all just sort of by consent. And there's also a different cultural mindset. You know, if you go to the standards meetings for the cellular folks, they're really looking for common solutions that can be used to build new chips and to build new switches and to offer new services to consumers and to build better phones. And it's more or less a vendor-oriented community, and so they all have an interest in making more money. And in the Internet Engineering Task Force, it's a very diverse, you know, it's this multi-stakeholder thing where you have some people that are really interested in developing better commercial product and making the experience and the business models work better for everybody. And you have an awful lot of other people who are just simply academics that, you know, that want to get something published by the IETF to help them, you know, get their dissertation completed. And you have some kind of old guard people that are really trying to prevent the internet from changing. You know, they pretty much feel that it was more or less perfect in about 1979. And to the extent that we deviate from that situation, we're just only messing it up.
So I have no idea which generation we're on, but I always refer to it as just 3.0 for sake of simplicity. Looking at the challenges we have with the trust in the system, especially since the old guard in 1979 just assumed everyone would know each other and we didn't have security on there, do you think that's an we're getting to a enough of a catalyst point where we need security if we want to do online banking, all these online commerce issues? Fraud rates still are relatively, you know, high. I mean, they're not huge, but they're high enough that they're a problem, as well as, you know, people getting their personally identifiable information stolen, which is creepy. Not unmanageable, but it's creepy. Do you think that those could be some of the driving points to get us to kind of what you're talking about and change the system to a naming protocol versus the current number protocol?
Yeah, I think that's certainly a big part of the mix. It is disturbing, you know, the number of attacks that take place against some fairly large institutions that you'd think would be pretty well protected, like Target.
Right, or JP Morgan.
And there are, you know, dozens of examples that we know about, and there are probably hundreds or thousands of examples that we don't know about because
Right.
the victim of the attack, you know, really didn't want to make it public.
Or the most recent, the Office of Personnel Management for the U.S. government.
Yeah, I mean that's pretty embarrassing, right? And the
Yeah.
Army just got—I think the DoD just got attacked a couple of days ago by China.
Maybe it'll finally become too big to ignore, and they'll have to make some major
Well,
changes.
I think that's what happens. But one thing I know about the internet is that it can change fairly rapidly when people are motivated.
Right.
You know, think about what had to happen in the mid-90s when Al Gore transformed the internet from a private research network that was only available to this small trusted community to a general purpose, you know, network open to the public. The most critical step there was turning off the National Science Foundation network that connected all the research sites and universities together and replacing it with commercial carriers like PSI and UUNET and Global Crossing, you know, the folks that were doing the long haul networking back in the day. In order for that to happen, we needed a new technical piece of the internet called BGP, Border Gateway Protocol. And unlike most IETF standards, BGP was designed, fully standardized and implemented within 18 months.
Wow.
And the reason that that happened, that, you know, there's a good story in the Washington Post recently about the advent of BGP and the fact that it was a three napkin protocol. You know, it took three bar napkins to sketch it all out, which means, you know, it's pretty complex.
Right.
And that happened in 18 months because it had to, because there was a date certain set for when the NSFNet was going to be decommissioned, and the internet would literally stop working when NSFNet was turned off, unless we had an alternative to go to, and BGP was a really crucial part of that. So it can happen, and I think it doesn't have to be crisis-driven. It could be opportunity-driven, that when we have 5G, as 5G comes together, and it's going to be probably about a 5 to 10 year process to get it all completely specified and really described in a detailed technical manner, so that people that work for different companies can build equipment that will interoperate with the equipment built by the other companies. While that's going on, if IETF is involved in the process, then we can actually achieve some of these more lofty goals, like the ones that Cisco has.
Back to BGP, can a security layer or an authentication or validation layer be put into the current BGP?
Well, folks have been trying to do that.
Is that a good idea?
It's gone through several generations.
Okay.
And but it's, if you start with what's fundamentally an insecure protocol, which BGP was in 1995, 96, and then try to add security to it later on, it never really works. Because they're just, you think you've covered all the possible points of attack, and then some clever hacker somewhere finds one that you didn't think about. Find some scenario where you could do a buffer overflow or make some obscure thing happen and get yourself an entry point into the system. So I think the missing thing here, if it really comes down to one thing, is that all the users of the system need to be authenticated and validated. I think the fundamental problem that we have is that we've always looked at the internet as a system where you can be fully anonymous if you want to.
Right.
But anonymity is not really consistent with security. I mean, one of the things that prevents people from behaving badly is accountability. I mean, there's nothing physically to prevent me from going out and using my shotgun to blow a hole in my neighbor's chest, you know, other than my fear of prosecution. I mean, there's no physical mechanism that prevents my shotgun from doing that. But, you know, I don't do it, well, because I like my neighbors, for one thing. But I, you know, really would not like to spend the rest of my life in prison.
Right.
But, you know, you can pretty much do anything you want on the internet if you're sufficiently well anonymized and not really have to fear any accountability. And I think we need to seriously revisit that trade-off. I mean, I see the value of anonymity for like whistleblowers and activists in authoritarian countries and whatnot. But I think that's probably 1 to 2% of the use that we want the internet to support. And I think for most applications, including those that involve commerce, you have to be authenticated. I don't want anybody using my credit card number without authentication. I just want for me to be able to do that.
Right. Interesting. And that's I know very little about it, but that's one of the things that people seem to misunderstand about blockchain and cryptocurrency, is that it actually isn't anonymized, from what I understand.
Mm-hmm.
You have actually potentially more credibility around who's moving things around if it's structured correctly. But that's a different topic. Can I get back?
Well, I mean, it doesn't actually have to be connected to a physical person. I think the way these things work is that they're essentially, you're connected to a virtual person. And somebody can, so you sort of, it's like you have a persona who is, who put the money in the account and takes the money out of the account. And there are ways to prevent other people from doing that because you have some credentials that nobody else knows. You have a secret that nobody else knows that enables you to extract money from your account. And you decide who you trust, with your money when you do that. But so it's a network equivalent of an identity. It's not a physical world identity. But I mean, isn't a lot of the motivation for these cryptocurrencies people that want to do things that are essentially illegal, like Silk Road?
It's definitely gotten a lot of attention for that, and I think it has been used for that. But I think there are, you know, bigger thinkers that are realizing there's opportunity there other than just mischief. But part of that is making sure that it does have an accountability mechanism tethered to it. So it's kind of the next generation.
I mean, I can see value in anonymous financial transactions. If, say, I want to give some money to support a political, revolutionary political movement in some authoritarian country, I don't want to name any names, but if I wanted to do that, I'd kind of like to be able to do that, right?
I'm pretty sure that's when most governments would like you to not be anonymous.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And so we kind of have a tension between status quo and,
right,
and you know, and freedom. So I'm all for freedom. I want to have enough accountability in the system so that my freedom is not being violated by some criminal that essentially wants to get access to my bank account.
You've brought up some very good topics there. So anything else of note? Obviously, there was quite a bit discussed in this 5G that's really interesting.
Yeah, and so the nobody really had any negative pushback on this Cisco vision. They've pretty well socialized it. I mean, there are lots of different people at Cisco have been telling this story for a while, and so they're in a kind of a consciousness-raising phase on it. I wouldn't say that there's any significant buy-in as of yet. There are lots of people. I mean, because the fact that the internet has some serious shortcomings and needs some additional design work done, it's recognized by the small community of network architects. We're talking about maybe 100 people in the world that really understand these issues. It's far from being a mainstream consensus thing, and that would be a big departure actually from what the cellular industry has done in the past with their generational standards. So the main difference, say, between 3G and 4G is better radios. And so the difference between 2G and 3G is better radios. And so that's always what a wireless generation, a cellular generation, has been. But this is taking a more holistic, much more expansive view and sort of looking at the overall ecosystem and what the pressure points are that need some improvement in order to just sort of keep moving the technology forward.
And you mentioned earlier the need for more spectrum. Is this something that will be considered as they look at the next generation spectrum auctions?
This is really even beyond that. I mean, the spectrum, all the spectrum auctions that are on the table are already worked into the timeline. And of course, 5G will be an international standard. So it's not simply a matter of what we're doing in the U.S., but what other countries can do. Right. And there's a big component of harmonization between different countries so that folks like Apple and Samsung can build a single phone that'll work pretty much anywhere in the world. But there's an exciting development in what's called millimeter wave radios, which is to say the radios that we have today for Wi-Fi and cellular operate in a range of frequencies from around 200 megahertz to about 6 gigahertz. And gigahertz meaning is sort of the way you characterize electromagnetic spectrum. And some of these frequencies are licensed and some are unlicensed, but they're all pretty much all spoken for. So the only way that we get more cellular spectrum below 6 gigahertz is to change an existing assignment from, say, something like, there's a lot of spectrum that was allocated by the regulators to satellite-based mobile services. And there's been very little uptake of that, because satellites are, it's just not a good way. You don't want to do phone calls that have to bounce off a satellite. It's really annoying. And so some of those frequencies have been re-regulated from satellite to terrestrial. So companies like LightSquared and the other satellite companies like DirecTV and Dish are looking at doing that for some of the spectrum that they hold. So that's the only thing we can do below 6 gigahertz is just change the assignment, because nobody's manufacturing any new spectrum in that range. But we have radio technology now that can use extremely high frequencies. And the millimeter waves are that, according to the FCC, it starts at about 24 gigahertz. So it's like essentially five times smaller than the radio waves that are used by the most advanced form of Wi-Fi, the 802.11ac, which is the thing that gives you gigabit over Wi-Fi. Oh, and by the way, the data rate goal for 5G that everybody buys into is 10 gigabits per second. So if you think you'd like to have a gigabit network in your home, well, you know, hang on for about 10 years and you'll probably have 10 gigabit wireless service everywhere, which would be, you know, that'd be fairly useful.
Right.
It'll
be so good, I'll never want to leave my house.
Yeah. And so in the millimeter waves, you can do enormously, you know, you can have networks that are enormously fast and that have really some excellent radio properties that make it possible to serve a lot of people from a common base station, because you essentially, everybody has their own little beam. And so my beam and your beam don't interfere with each other, which is really cool. But the downside of it is that, if there's a leaf or a building in the way, it tends to disrupt the signal. And so there's some clever engineering going on to mitigate the effects of physical objects that are in the path from, say, the mobile device to the tower.
So what makes it more sensitive?
It's just because it's a smaller wave. So the radios that we use today, it's kind of hard to visualize if you're not an engineer, but you can think of it like so kind of imagine a sine wave, right? It's like a wave in the ocean that's crashing up on the beach. The waves in a set of waves, they're kind of evenly spaced, right? And so the distance between the peak of one wave and the peak of the following wave would be the wavelength. And if you if that wavelength is bigger than a tree, then the signal can pass by the tree, because the tree can't disrupt the entire signal. It can only disrupt a portion of it. And there's still enough left that the tree didn't interfere with that we can extract information from it. But if the wavelength is really small, and so it's like a millimeter wave, it's literally millimeters from a wavelength, then one single leaf can absorb or deflect the entire wave. And most of the radio that we get today actually comes into our houses through the windows. And okay. So when the wavelength is substantially larger than the windows, then, you know, it doesn't all get through. And so our service is a little bit degraded. If it's sort of perfectly sized to the window, that's an optimal situation. And if it's much, much smaller, well, that's cool too, as long as there's not, you know, a leaf or a tree or something outside the window that could block it.
So going back to the beginning of this discussion, we were talking about 5G and how it's a really high def for voice. I feel like this is kind of running a little counter to it. Like it might be stronger, but it's more sensitive.
Yeah. So what they do is they, one of the, I was talking about clever engineering. So instead of a single antenna in your phone and a single antenna in the base station, if you have dozens of antennas within your phone and at the base station, and each one of those follows a slightly different path, then you can overcome the effects of an individual leaf on an individual signal.
So it becomes its own grid mesh.
Yeah.
On a smaller scale.
Yeah. And this is called Massively Multi-User MIMO. And MIMO is an acronym that means multiple input, multiple output. So it's essentially, instead of relying on a single antenna to talk to a single antenna, you have dozens of antennas talking to dozens of antennas.
So that reminds me of a conversation you and I had when we were in Dallas and we were talking about the stadium. Is that the same kind of thing that they're using for like large scale events where you have a lot of people trying to pull from the network?
Yeah, it's sort of a more advanced version of that. And the Wi-Fi network that's in the Dallas Cowboys Stadium today, they I think they say they support 4x4, which is to say four antennas, a maximum of four antennas on either end of a single connection. And so we just take that concept a few steps further. If the wavelength is shorter because the frequency is higher, then you can have more antennas. And so the very properties of these electromagnetic waves that make propagation difficult in the heretofore conventional manner of designing radio networks makes them really ideal for a new way of designing radio networks. So what happens is you have to have an infrastructure that's pretty flexible and that allows you to do different things at different frequencies, which is what the electromagnetic spectrum more or less demands to get efficiency and performance. So we have challenges if we insisted on doing things the old way, but if we're willing to develop these new technologies, and actually multi-user MIMO is something that's been on the books for about 15 years.
And is it the combination of like the device or, you know, that is looking for where are you putting the flexibility in the system? So it's seeking something and it doesn't get tied into only looking for one particular thing. So
it adapts. I mean, so your phone will be capable of using a range of different frequencies. As they kind of are today, right? You can use cellular or you can use Wi-Fi. And your phone has ways of selecting, well, am I going to make this connection over Wi-Fi or over cellular? And it will prefer cellular for telephone calls. But for data, it'll prefer Wi-Fi if that's available because you just have more spectrum available to you if you're using Wi-Fi.
So when I'm in a situation, I'm not sure this is maybe more data-driven, not voice, but where I get the option to get off the cellular network onto Wi-Fi, and I'm noticing that more in commercial areas and in stores.
Yeah.
Am I as a consumer benefiting that, or is that the best benefit just it stops pulling from cellular and goes onto somebody's Wi-Fi network? I mean, it's just a matter of traffic control.
Well, it's excuse me, like when you use, if you're in a retail store and you're shopping, there are systems that will track you around the store and essentially give the retailer some information about what you're looking at. So if you're looking at scarves, they know that you're in the scarf section. They could actually send ads to your phone that, you know, tout some scarf that they particularly want to sell you. And so it benefits the retailer having that information about you, but the benefit to you is that you're not using your cellular data plan when you're connecting over Wi-Fi, which is, I think, the advantage that most people, you know, see in it. I mean, and sometimes it's an awful lot faster.
Okay.
And so this is the trade-off that we make on the internet, right? This is why we get all these free services.
Right.
Because we're giving up personal information that can be monetized by the advertising merchants, and that the money that they make subsidizes, you know, the websites and the services that we use that we don't have to pay for. So So while we think we're getting it for free, we're actually, you know, selling a little piece of our souls to get that. But I guess maybe it's a small enough piece that most people don't mind.
To go back to the scarf analogy, so it knows through basic the geography of where I'm standing in the store, and they've programmed to know that's where the scarves are. So we're not talking about a visual. It's just a geolocation. I'm in this part of the store. This is where the scarves are.
Yeah, I think in most cases it's geolocation.
Hopefully, right? Yeah. So it's exchanging that information with my phone because I've agreed to use their Wi-Fi. What else is it pulling off that other than my geolocation and what it might be able to send me ads to it? Do I have a concern for my personal security or my privacy, or did I give that up when I agreed to use their Wi-Fi?
Well, I think the only thing they know about you is actually that you're a shopper and you're in a certain location.
So they don't necessarily know it's my, who I am, other than it's just going off the element of where my phone's located.
So it always has the location. And, a lot of these commercially provided free Wi-Fi services, they're only available to people who have joined a loyalty club.
But then they're also, they probably can connect that data to me.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so if you want to use Wi-Fi in Kempton hotels, you can either pay for it for, I think it's like $5 or $10 a night, something like that. Or else you can join their loyalty club. And if you join their loyalty club, they know, you know, your name, your address, your telephone number, and they can connect that with your travel history as far as you've stayed in their properties.
What about my browsing habits?
They could. I mean, they could collect your browsing habits while you're staying in the hotel.
From using their Wi-Fi, right?
Yeah. I mean, they certainly could do that.
So if this really makes, it creeps you out, you should spend a lot of time reading the terms of use.
Yeah, I think we all need to get, somebody needs to provide like a virtual lawyer that will sort of read these terms of use and point things out to us that could be troublesome.
Maybe we need to go the real American way and put symbols on it.
Well, you know,
or red, yellow, green. Emojis.
Like, yeah, you should either get a happy face or a sad face or a nervous face or something. Yeah.
I want to see the emoticon for a nervous face. If you find that, will you send that to me?
They're probably, I'm sure there is. Yeah.
I've adopted the koala bear as my happy face because I don't know why else it exists. That's really interesting. So going back to the store, because I don't know the difference. What is it when they have a beacon? Explain what the beacon is to me.
Well, a beacon is an image that's in a web page that's only one pixel. So, and the point of a beacon is that when you see like a real image on a web page, you provide a lot of information to the source of that image about who you are, what browser you're using, what kind of computer you have, what operating system you have. There's all just tons of stuff that changes hands every time you download an image into a web page. So in order to install a cookie on your browser, some of these services use invisible images, basically. So there's a beacon is this a one pixel image which you can't see that's embedded in a web page in order to provide an advertiser typically with information about you know, who you are and where you are and what you're doing.
And is that most likely used on a commercial website? So if I go to Home Depot and I'm looking at washer dryers, or are they dropping something? I mean, am I opening one of these pixels at that point? When am I doing that?
Well, when you're on Home Depot's site and you're browsing for stuff on or searching for stuff on the Home Depot site, Home Depot knows who you are. So if there are beacons embedded in their pages, it's actually to provide that information to third parties other than Home Depot.
The advertisers that they...
Yeah, advertisers. And this is, I think, part of the reason that, like, kind of seems to me that the main purpose of internet advertising today is to remind you of what you just bought on Amazon 2 days ago.
So I can go buy it again. Like I have amnesia.
Yeah. I mean, don't you see a lot of, if you buy stuff on, I don't know.
Yeah, I know. I never quite understand that. I'm like, I just bought that. Why do they think I want another one so soon?
Yeah. Amazon itself will do that.
Yeah.
I mean, you buy something. I've bought stuff on Amazon and literally within seconds, Amazon was trying to sell me a different, more or less equivalent version of the thing I just bought from them. And it's like, what are you, do you like make money on returns? I mean, but yeah, you certainly, I was browsing for office chairs once and for like 2 months after that, I got office chair ads, you know, everywhere I went on the internet practically. And it's just sort of bizarre. So I think the ecosystem for personalized advertising is not nearly as well developed as it really needs to be useful to consumers as well as to retailers. But, you know, we're getting there. I mean, obviously it's better, you know, it's better than it was in its early days when you just got banner ads all over the place. And they very often had nothing whatsoever to do with what you're actually interested in. But I mean, if I could get ads for things that I would really like to buy, and I just sort of am not aware that somebody has developed that product yet or where I would go about buying it. There are lots of things that would make my life, you know, easier and more fun and more productive, that I think about, but I'm not really aware of the fact that there could actually be a well-developed, you know, industry around some gizmo that I just thought up.
Right.
Yeah. It'd be nice to know that.
Yeah. You're right. They need to get to the next part of your thought process. I'm sure that they're already there. They just haven't figured out how to get it on this very slow, old-fashioned internet.
Yeah. Well, it could be part of it.
Right. Hey, Richard, I think we probably...
Well, thanks for the talk, Shane. And for the listeners, please stop by the forums at the hightechforum.org website. Just click on the forums tab to discuss what you heard here and check your podcast feed in 2 weeks for a conversation with Dino Flore, the chairman of the 3GPP Radio Access Network Standards Group that's making all this possible.